Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for standing by. Welcome to today's WPP conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today, Friday, the 12th of July, 2019. I will now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, WPP CEO Mark Read. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks very much, and good morning, everybody. I'm here in Sea Containers House with Andrew Scott, our COO, and with Erik Strandin, the Chief Executive of Kantar, and with Luca Bassi, Managing Director of Bain Capital, our new partner with Kantar. In December, on December 11th last year, we laid out our strategy, our new strategy for WPP, and really a three-year plan to return the business to growth, to simplify the company, and to reduce our leverage. Today is another important step on that journey. It's been a very competitive process, and we've had significant interest in the company. I think we view this as a good deal for WPP and a good deal for Kantar as a company, for its people, and for its clients. Bain are an excellent partner for us. They've got a very strong track record with companies such as Worldpay, and we're very pleased that financially and strategically, at the end of what was a long and complex process, we've ended up with a really strong partner. I think this deal is not a reflection or transaction, but a reflection on the quality of Kantar. We still believe that it's a very strong company, but really what we need to do at WPP to simplify, to focus, and to delever. An important point we'll get into in the presentation is data remains a critical component of our strategy, but we have shifted somewhat from a focus on how we use data in our marketing, not per se, if we own it or not. Our shareholders will benefit from the future success of the company through 40% shareholding, and I think that's important to us. At the same time, we can hit the bottom range of our leverage target a year ahead of target. If you take the 2.5 billion pounds we're raising here and just over 1 billion pounds we've raised since April, when we started in April last year, the end of Q1, we had net debt of 5.2 billion pounds. We've raised 3.5 billion pounds against that net debt, and we'll use 1 billion of that to return to shareholders. We'll get onto that later on. Turning to the presentation, which you should all have in front of you, turning to page three and sort of highlights the transaction. First, this is really a partnership for growth. We have a strong plan for Kantar, really focused around investing in the company, developing into the world's leading data and insight and consulting business, combining the expertise of both partners, the revenue and client base of WPP and Bain. It's important for WPP's clients that they retain access to the data that we have in Kantar. It really aligns our interest in the next phase of its evolution through the shareholding structure. Secondly, it gives WPP much greater focus and a simpler structure, focusing us on our core business as a creative transformation company. Kantar is around 15% of our revenues and profits and allows us to really focus on the 85% and returning that to growth while having a very strong partner on the 15% that's Kantar and significantly simplifies our structure. It supports really a differentiated data strategy. If you go back to December 11th, I think we really laid out a very comprehensive plan to transform WPP both creatively and technologically. Data is at the heart of our technology strategy. As I said, it's really around delivering data-driven solutions to our clients through the usage of data, not the ownership. We will retain access to all Kantar data as part of what we're thinking of is like the data supply chain. It's really how do we help our clients get access to the right piece of data to answer a particular question, to derive a particular insight, to know where to target a message, and to measure the results of their activities. Really that's the focus we have from a data perspective. Fourthly, it leaves us with a much stronger balance sheet. And our priority, you know, both Andrew and my priority, you know, when we started, was really to put the balance sheet in a stronger position. And we've done that through a series, you know, looking at the investments and associates we have in the company. And, you know, this really does take us to the bottom end of the range, as I said, a year ahead of targets. We're going to use around 60% of the proceeds to delever. So we talked during the process of around 50-50. I think where we are now is, you know, 60%, so around £1.5 billion to delever is the right number, and it's the right balance between, you know, getting our balance sheet in a position where, you know, we're in a strong position going forward and returning enough proceeds to shareholders at the same time. And then finally, you know, we think this is a strong, this is really a strong position of creating value for shareholders, which, you know, from the beginning has been our focus. You know, the headline enterprise value of around $4 billion or £3.2 billion represents a multiple of 8.2 times 2018 headline EBITDA. We will return around £1 billion to shareholders. You know, Andrew will come on to explain the transaction and the process, but we're really expected to minimize the dilution of the earnings in 2021. And there is continued upside for WPP shareholders through the 40% equity stake. And as I say, I think the competitive nature of the process has really got us to a good place in terms of the price for the business. So those are really the highlights. On page four, just turning to Kantar itself, and Eric can answer more detailed questions later, I think it's really a very strong company. It's really the leader in its industry of data, research, consulting, analytics. But it's also in a market that's undergoing, I think like the rest of WPP, a period of structural change and structural transformation. It has a very strong global reach, you know, like the rest of WPP, really strong presences in the key faster-growing markets, China, Brazil, India, around the world. It's got deep proprietary permission-based data sets and panels in World Panel and Kantar Media, increasingly important in a world where, you know, we need to be GDPR compliant and have permission from consumers on how we, you know, use and manage their data, and a very broad offer across a large number of sectors. It's an independent, trusted brand, and I think that will be of particular importance going forward, and to some extent, you know, not being part of WPP will open up other opportunities to Kantar, which I think are interesting. And in 2018, as I say, it represented around 15% of the group's revenues and profits. The plan on page five going forward, and Eric and Luke can talk to you a little bit more about this, is really to unlock the growth potential in Kantar. We think we have a strong plan, not a plan based on cost reduction, but a plan based on investing in talent, in scaling the products that Kantar has through technology, analytics, and through automation. As I said, you know, like WPP's business, you know, the data business is being transformed by technology, and, you know, it does require greater investment and greater focus, and we think that this is a good structure to allow us to do that. Bain Capital brings a very strong experience and a track record in carve-outs, and that will be combined with a continuing relationship with WPP, with our clients and with our people, that's important. And we will have, as WPP, the right to appoint two of the eight directors. Just turning briefly on page six, you know, to, you know, the question that I think some of you have, what, you know, what does this mean for WPP's data strategy, particularly in the light of transactions by, you know, some of our peers? I think that the point to make is that, you know, data and Kantar data will remain critical to WPP. And what we've laid out on page six, you know, really is a way to think about the data that we use to support our business and support decision making in our business. And there's really sort of three chunks of data. There's the data that sits inside WPP, the data that our clients have, often known as first-party data, and the data that sits inside the broader sort of digital ecosystem. And to do, you know, effective marketing for our clients, we need to have access to all three areas of data. You know, what's critical really is having the right piece of data at the right time to answer the right question. So in terms of sort of the data we have from WPP, there's been three broad buckets. There's the consumer data, transaction data that sits inside businesses like Wunderman Thompson or Ogilvy, and we have data sets there like iBehavior and AmeriLINK that have consumer and transaction data that are more akin to some of the data that sits inside Merkle or Acxiom or Epsilon. Secondly, GroupM, as a result of the media, the digital media that it plans and buys, does collect significant amounts of data on audiences, on campaigns, on media investments. And in particularly the media planning and buying business, I think scale is moving from buying scale to data scale. We have significant investments in technology to collect that data. And then lastly, there's the data that sits inside Kantar around media panels, purchase panels or world panel, and the insight data. And we'll remain or retain access to that data part of this transaction. Secondly, there's the data that clients have. And lastly, there's the data in the broader ecosystem. And, just point out that we have around 1,000 data partnerships globally through WPP with people in that business, not just the sort of Googles and Facebooks and Amazons of the world, but also the Alibaba, Tencents of the world in markets like China. And really, I think our expertise is going to be focused on connecting that. And on page 7, shifting it from what do we own to how do we use it. And then a sort of simple kind of marketing funnel from insights to relevance to impact, there's a broad area of data that we're collecting. So strategy and planning data, we have a broad effort going on through GroupM to ensure that we collect all of the data that results from the campaigns that we run. We also have a big data management business that helps clients manage their own data and link that through to the campaigns. And the critical capability from a group perspective really is twofold. The first is the ability to resolve identity that we have through the Wunderman data business that's now broadly available to the rest of WPP, and the second to manage customer data, where we have a significant effort underway to migrate our sort of traditional data management business to the cloud. And I think that cloud-based solutions will disrupt and open up that business in a very interesting way. And that sits on top of what we call WPP.data, so our broader data ecosystem. So I think that really this transaction supports the new data strategy for WPP in a meaningful way. So Andrew will now just take us through the highlights of the transaction.
Thank you, Mark. So on just turning to page 8 now on the deck, what we've tried to do here is just outline in a simple way how we track through from the headline enterprise value to the sort of net cash proceeds for WPP on completion. So on the left-hand side, headline enterprise value, as we've said, 8.2 times WPP's 2018 headline EBITDA for Kantar of £386 million. That's a number that excludes the WPP central overhead allocation that would be typically in the numbers as we presented them historically, but effectively the £386 for 2018 is the right number to think about, which is how we come out at the 8.2. We step from headline enterprise value to the estimated equity value of completion or the gross proceeds as we think about it. And really that the bridging items between there are the non-controlling interest. Kantar doesn't own 100% of all of the business it owns. There's minorities in some of the businesses, and the $4 billion is on a 100% basis. So really the largest item in that bridge is the minority interest, but there's other debt-like adjustments, pensions, et cetera, between those two lines. That gives you the gross proceeds of $3.7 billion. 83% of that converts into the net cash proceeds. And when we discuss the transaction at a high level in the Investor Day, we talked about 80% conversion into net cash proceeds. So, and that's really a function of the the bridge between there is the cost of us reinvesting in 40% of the new Kantar company, which will obviously have more leverage in it as part of that model, and our tax and transaction costs. On the far right-hand side, you have the estimated net cash proceeds of $3.1 billion or 2.5 billion pounds, and our ownership stake, the 40% ownership stake in Kantar. As Mark has outlined, we see that stake as very strategic from a client and offer perspective. You know, we're also excited about that stake from a value creation perspective. We think, you know, with Bain as a partner, we can make a good return on that 40% investment. As we turn to page nine, which really picks up at the $3.1 billion of net proceeds, $3.1 billion that is, or 2.5 billion pounds. As Mark has outlined, we're gonna return 60% of that. We think that's the right mix in terms of debt paydown, 1.5 billion sterling based on today's exchange rates. You know, when we outlined the strategy last year, we talked about our objective to get our average net debt to EBITDA ratio into the 1.5-1.75 times range by 2021. What this use of proceeds does is take us to the bottom of that range, and it takes us to the bottom of that range a year early. In a way, the standalone plan to our minds was getting us halfway between the 1.5-1.75 by 2021. This takes us to the, you know, the 1.5 end, and it takes us there a year early. That leaves 1 billion pounds of return for shareholders, and we'll come back to you at the right time on how exactly we plan to do that. Then we've given you a little bit of guidance in terms of our views on the sort of EPS impact, which is obviously based on a number of assumptions around share price, et cetera. You know, as guidance, we're saying mid-single digit dilution in 2020 and marginally dilutive in 2021. The exact impact of that will obviously depend on a number of factors as you know. I think as we look at that dilution, you know, that dilution, it's important to stress that that's a combination of two things. One, the transaction itself, and two, the decision to delever. As we said in the press release, in terms of dividend policy, it will remain as it is. It will remain unchanged, which is effectively a 0.60 per share dividend until we get back to 1.20 of earnings. I'm gonna move on to page 10, which is really where we're trying to sort of give you some thoughts on timing and the overall transaction conditionality. I think the message here is we expect the transaction will close in early 2020. We're confident that the transaction will close. You know, as is typical on a transaction of this nature, there's a number of, it is conditional on a number of factors. I'll actually move to the bottom of the page just to go through what those conditions are. It is a Class 1 transaction under the listing rules, so we will have an EGM and a shareholder vote, which is based on a simple majority. There is a number of antitrust clearances that we need from regulators in the EU, the USA, and seven other countries. Just to be clear, we don't see any material issues on these clearances. Bain does not have a sort of business that's in their portfolio that looks like Kantar. This is really just a function of the size. You know, Bain is a big private equity firm that has businesses in a number of countries, and just by virtue of their sheer size in those countries, you have to go through a regulatory clearance. We will be going through that. The third aspect, of the transaction is it's conditional on us implementing our Kantar reorganization. Now, that sounds a big sort of thing, but that's, we have a very sort of clear view on our steps there. It's really just process. We, at the moment, Kantar is, you know, contained within different legal entities across WPP. We just have to go through the steps to bring it into a holding structure to facilitate the transaction. The reason we haven't done that in advance is just because you do trigger taxes from those steps. So until we got to the point of implementing the transaction, you didn't want to do that, but the, obviously the teams have a very clear plan of how that happens. And there's no issues in any way from that step. And the final sort of conditionality is when we've got sort of 86% roughly of the EBITDA inside the holding structure and with the relevant antitrust clearances passed, the transaction completes. So and that's the early 2020, as I indicated. We expect that first completion to happen. Some of the other countries will take a little longer to get into the structure, and you will effectively have a number of completion steps, but 86% of the business and the associated proceeds will come in that first completion step, and the remainder will follow on afterwards. And with that, I think I'll hand back to Mark.
Okay, so just in summary, I think as we said when we started, you know, we set out the plan on December 11th last year to return, you know, WPP to growth, and you know, this is an important step in that process. It's really a partnership with Bain Capital to create the world's leading data company with a strong plan, focused on investments in technology and people. It will strengthen our balance sheet, you know, reducing our leverage to the lower end of the range a year ahead of plan. Of the £2.5 billion of net cash proceeds, we'll return £1 billion to shareholders, and we'll talk, you know, at the appropriate time on the method by which we'll do that. From a WPP shareholder value perspective, which really is our focus, it's a good transaction from a shareholder perspective, and our shareholders will benefit from, you know, a meaningful stake in the next phase of Kantar's evolution through their 40% equity participation. And last but not least, you know, our strength in data, our focus on using data in our marketing, and the investments in technology that we need to make to do that remain. So that's sort of the summary. Myself, Andrew, Luca and Eric are here to take questions. We'll take the first question.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. As a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press the hash key. Once again, please press star 1 if you wish to ask a question. Our first question comes from the line of Adrien de Saint-Hilaire. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning everyone, and congrats on the deal. So I've got a few questions, please. At the Q1 stage, Kantar organic sales growth was a bit better than the group average. Would that be the case also for the first half and for 2019? The second question, perhaps for Mark, after the deal is completed, you'll have about 50% of your revenues coming from advertising and media. And that is probably where the structural changes that you've described are the strongest. So are you comfortable with this revenue exposure? And then thirdly, maybe for Andrew, do the 2021 targets, do they change after the Kantar transaction?
Okay, so...
just on the first comment, on the first, because we've got to go with the Class 1 transaction, we're not going to be giving any sort of guidance on the performance of Kantar on this.
Yeah, we'll release Kantar's results when we're ready to release them, I'm afraid, Adrian. So you'll get the first half results when we release our first half results. On the structure of the company, look, I think I think you said from the beginning, all of WPP is undergoing, all of the industries we're operating in are being changed by technology, just like all of our clients' businesses. And Kantar is no different, and the rest of WPP is no different. I mean, I think, you're doing what I expected you to do to some extent, which is we solve one problem and then you go and find another problem. I think our focus, what this does is make our tasks somewhat easier. We can focus on, the 85% of WPP that's not Kantar, if you like. So I think that, it should make it easier for us to navigate our way through the transformation in our business. I've been clear, I don't think our business is going through a period of structural decline. It's going through a period of structural change, and greater focus should make it easier for us to navigate our way through this. So I would see that as a positive, not as a negative. And I think, the business that Kantar operates in is probably, if anything, going through greater structural change than the rest of WPP. And in some ways, the fact that the data and insight business is going through a period of greater structural change is what makes this structure attractive to us, because we have a partner and we can focus our, they can focus their time and attention on really doing what needs to be done at Kantar. So, I don't view that as a negative, but, as expected, I think will tick the leverage box in your mind, and your attention will rightly go, like ours is, to how we return the rest of WPP to growth.
On the targets, I don't think we're, we laid out our plan on the investor day in terms of 2021 peer group net sales, like for like net sales growth, and the 15% operating profit margins, and on a pre-IFRS 16 basis. There's the Kantar business. We're not going to talk about the growth in terms of Kantar. You can see the historical growth. But I wouldn't say there's any reason to change that guidance that we gave. And on a margin perspective, Kantar is fairly close to the group margin. It's a tad higher if you exclude the central overhead allocation, but really it's more similar to the average group margin than different. So again, I don't think there's any reason to be adjusting that target, and the same would go for the sort of cash flow conversion target. So in short, we're not sort of communicating any change to that guidance.
Okay, thank you very much. But perhaps just a quick follow-up, given what you said, Mark, about Kantar going through more structural challenges. Do you feel more comfortable about hitting the 2021 targets now that Kantar is out of the business, or out of the P&L, or the consolidated P&L?
I don't think it's a question of being more comfortable or less comfortable. I think it's really, we set out a plan, and this was part of the plan. So I think we remain as confident as we did in December in achieving the plan. It's really a question of, investments in people, in creativity, the focus on North America. So I think this helps us do that, because, we can it's a further sort of focus and simplification of the business. And I think that, that's really what we're trying to do. So, and it's not really a question of more or less confident. I think that, what we're pleased is, we said we'd set out to do something, and that's really what we've done. So
I mean, Adrian, just mathematically, it's 15% of the group. So it's a big company, and a strong company. But we'd have to get it in perspective. It's 15% of the net sales of the group. So I don't think there'd be any reason to be changing the overall guidance on that basis.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Julian Roch from Barclays. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. My first question is, how much gearing will Kantar take on board in terms of net debt to EBITDA? The second one is, you're now at the bottom of your gearing target of 1.5 to 1.75. So will you start to reinvest? What kind of M&A envelope we can expect in 2020, and what areas will you invest in? And last question is, if Ben was merging Kantar with another data business, would you think about being diluted, or would you think about investing alongside Ben? Thank you.
So what? I'll take the second question, and without making it too complicated, Andrew take the first and the third, and maybe Luke or Eric might want to add to that. You know, I think that in terms of, you're right, we get to the bottom of our range, and I think it gives us the flexibility to make acquisitions. I think we've said that our focus on acquisitions will be sort of not just adding to the size and scale of the group, but you know, really differentiated acquisitions that build our offer, that primarily will be, I think, in the technology area, but also perhaps in the creative area, because of the two areas where we need to focus our efforts. So I think we'll be looking at businesses in line with that. There aren't changes to our, you know, target in terms of the sort of absolute amount of acquisitions we laid out in the plan, but it does give us a bit more flexibility. So we're not going to go crazy, but we will continue to look at acquisitions. We made a small acquisition in Italy, Aquest, about 2 weeks ago. Very interesting, you know, creative and technology-driven agency focused in the luxury space. So I think you should expect to see, you know, smaller but strategically differentiated acquisitions.
On the leverage, I mean, Julian, you know, with Bain here, I'll let them comment if they would like on the exact numbers on that, and I imagine they wouldn't want to do that. I mean, Kantar's a very stable, cash-generative business that can support leverage in these transactions. There is a range that is typically used. And really, you've got the maths to sort of back into that number. I'll let you do it. But you see that you know the cost we're investing at, for what proportion, you know the headline multiple. So I'll let you do the maths in terms of backing out into that number. And going forward, in terms of investing in M&A, we will work with Bain on the right capital structure for those transactions. We will have the right to participate with them and invest should we choose to do so if there was any M&A, but it's not something that gives us great concern. Bain cares very much about its equity. They use leverage as part of the model, so it's not something we have any great concerns about in terms of participating alongside them if there is some inorganic activity in the future in Kantar.
Yeah, and it's Luca Bassi from Bain Capital here. What I would say is we have financed a transaction with a traditional standard sort of private equity deal capital structure where, of course, the majority is coming from leverage. At the same time, I just want to be very clear that the investment thesis is not around financial engineering and the leveraging. It is a story of, it's an industrial project, it's a story of growth and repositioning of the business and investing more, both in technology as well as for the right opportunities, as Andrew said, in potential inorganic, if there are interesting situations that they can bring in capabilities, technology that can help us to work there, it can accelerate the execution of the ambitious targets in the business plan.
Okay, very clear. Thank you very much, and congratulations on the deal.
Thanks, Julian.
Next question comes from the line from William Packer from Exane. Please go ahead.
Hi, Will from Exane BNP Paribas here. Thanks for taking my questions. Firstly, you've talked about the strategic benefit of Bain joining the project. Organic growth at Kantar has been weak, I think, for the last 5 years. Can Bain help growth accelerate, and how? Secondly, we kind of touched on in the last question, but it feels at this point in the economic cycle, the leverage will be pretty high. Could you talk through the cyclicality at Kantar? My memory is that it was the worst performing unit in the financial crisis at WPP. How can we gain some confidence there? And lastly, just to clarify on the data points, it sounds like Kantar remains an important part of the WPP offering, and as part of the transaction, you still have access to that data. What happens when Bain inevitably exits down the road? Do you continue to have access to that data, or is that a risk at a later point? Thank you.
So I'll take the last question, and then Eric can talk a little bit about the plan from his perspective. I think on data, you know, there is a very well-developed sort of data market, and you know, we'll continue to have access to the data when Kantar is in this structure, and I would imagine and fully expect that we'll continue to have access to the data from Kantar in a different structure as well. So I don't think that that's really an issue in any way, to be honest. I think that, as I said, there's a very well-trodden market for, you know, buying and selling data, particularly in the US, and you know, this is a number of sources. So I don't have any concerns around that. And Eric, why don't you talk to the plan?
Yeah, we've spent 6 months working up a business plan, which has really been stress test by Bain and by a number of other people who were looking at us over the recent period. And I think we all feel very confident in delivering that plan, and actually with Bain's help, to be able to go beyond that plan. We've invested very heavily in innovation over the last few years, and we're beginning to see that the fruits of that innovation coming through. And if I think about recent partnerships and business wins, you know, the likes of ByteDance in the last week, the world's biggest app company entrusting us with their business, and the likes of Alibaba, who have got all of our analytics inside the Ali cloud, with whom we do work, and the likes of Google, who we build single source panels for. So we're a very innovative company that works with what you would consider to be the leading tech players in the world, who are no slouches and are very kind of forward-looking, as well as our traditional multinational and big local clients. So the innovation has been there. The business plan is there. We think we can accelerate more. We think there's opportunities to really scale our products and services beyond what we've got in the business plan. There's opportunities to invest in talent and build some of the capabilities that we would otherwise be unable to do so at scale. So I think we all feel pretty good, actually, about being able to partner and go forward and accelerate the things that we've already been working on. GDPR has been good for us. We have the largest first-party panels in the world around media and purchase. We've got incredible insights which deliver an understanding for our clients about what's happening and why it's happening, and a global reach that no one else has got in the industry, not consulting companies, not traditional research companies. So I think we actually feel pretty good about all of that, and I think in Bain we found a partner who is equally ambitious and wants to help us grow the business.
And William, just on the leverage, to pick up on the third question you asked there, you know, and again, I'll let Luca go into any more details, but it's a very competitive finance market for companies like Bain in these transactions. We've obviously looked at the plan, and we're very comfortable with the interest coverage. It's actually a very stable business, very cash generative, so we don't have any concerns whatsoever in terms of the leverage plan.
Yeah,
great.
And
sorry, carry on.
Just a couple of comments on these. As Andrew said, clearly the business that our story, as I said before, is not a financial engineering. So we have a very patient capital structure with effectively no covenants, and so we have a lot of flexibility in light of the cash generation of the group. I think the second important point, which is pretty much around our thesis, if you think about the larger portion of the Kantar business the panel, Boswell panel and audience measurement is pretty much a very recurring sort of business model, which is quite stable across the cycle. And then there is a portion, of course, which is the insights and which is more project-based. And there, we do believe that as economy becomes difficult, companies will want to be more and more sophisticated about the way they spend their money and how they invest. And clearly, in order to make more critical decision, they will need more accurate and sophisticated data. And that is where Kantar really can be differentiated vis-a-vis the competition, probably more in a difficult time rather than in a good time.
William, just one final comment. I mean, we don't have any concerns, as I've said, but just to be, in case it's not obvious, the debt within Kantar is within the Kantar perimeter. There's no, you know, it should be thought of as a standalone project from the debt perspective as you think about overall WPP.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Next question comes from the line of Matthew Walker from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi. Hi, Mark. Thanks, and good morning to everyone. Well done for getting the deal over the line. I got a couple of questions. The first one was, you mentioned on your on the buying business, you said that basically the advantages in buying scale is now actually moving to data scale. Just interested in your thoughts around whether you think, I mean, clearly the old world, quite an oligopoly in buying scale, but in data, do you have lower barriers to entry for data scale? And don't you have a lot of new players in the sense of, you know, Amazon, Facebook, and Google in that space? So comparing the two things, the old world and the new world, is it not much tougher to play and be a data scale business? The second question is going back to one of the slides on the, again, on the data, I think it was number 6, looking at that ecosystem. I guess my question is, maybe it's in the Wunderman Thompson area, but does the data that you have in terms of when it's been given permission by the consumer, does that allow you to track the consumer when they are using Google, when they're in the Facebook app, and when they're using Amazon, so that actually you've got a decent enough representation of what those customers are doing to advise your clients without actually getting the data directly from Facebook, Google, and Amazon? So I'm just wondering about the quality and size of your data and what it actually allows you to do there.
Yeah,
I hope that's clear. Sorry, it was a bit garbled.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's clear. I mean, just to sort of explain how we think about it, and I think it's interesting actually, particularly in the context of, you know, commentary from people on, you know, insourcing of media, that people don't perhaps understand the full benefits of working with a partner like Group M. You know, I think if you work with Group M and buy digital media and programmatic media from them, you get access to, you know, obviously the performance data of your campaigns and the audience insights that come from that, but you also get access to the audience insights of all of Group M's campaigns on a sort of permission-based basis. And you also get access to the normative data that comes through the campaigns that they run, i.e., you know, we know what are the best 5 campaigns that run for an automotive company, or what are the best ways of buying social media. And so I think that the data advantages come, you know, really in several respects, from how we can use the data to go, how we can work with clients to use their data and activate it in particular channels. You know, so if I give you a good example, so we work with a US telco, and we basically took their data, imported it into Google Customer Match, and we were able to adjust the bids on Google depending on whether or not a particular search came from that telco's customer or a non-customer. As a result, we were able to improve the effectiveness of their search spend by 40%. And that's something that I think that, you know, we can deliver to clients through application of their data. So I think that there aren't lower barriers to entry as a result of the business moving from sort of the old world, if you like, to the new world. If anything, the barriers to entry are greater. I think the second point I'd make is that it's not like the old world has gone away. You know, the old world is still there and is critically important. And I think that you'll see, you know, in many of the media pitches that actually clients want the integration between, you know, the analog and the digital. And what's interesting is increasingly they're using the insights they get from the digital media to drive into the analog media. So you haven't seen, I don't think, a great degree of disintermediation of the traditional media businesses. If anything, I think the traditional media businesses have retained their position across both the analog and the digital media, and companies that focus just on digital media have found it hard to scale, have not got into the major media pitches, and are really still operating, you know, on the periphery of the digital media business and certainly the broader traditional media business. You know, I can't think of a major media pitch where a digital-only company has had a meaningful role in that. So I think that the advantages that we have, you know, will persist. And actually why clients come to us is the ability to look at data across Google, across Facebook, across Amazon. And so I think our ability to look across all of the media channels is what gives us a competitive advantage. And, you know, that persists in the future. So, you know, I think that we're, you know, it comes to your question about Facebook and Google. It's not that we're taking data from them into our business. It's really we're giving clients the ability to look across them and work out for a particular campaign what's the most effective channel for that campaign. And I think we remain in a good position in that. So sorry for the long answer, but I think it's an important question and important to sort of understand the dynamics that are going on there.
And if I can just add, I mean, I think there's sometimes some confusion as to, you know, what is our data from a Kantar point of view and what we can do with it. There's some data, I mean, if we do a piece of brand tracking for a client, that data belongs to the client. Now, some of those clients want us to share the insights with their media agencies and their creative agencies, whoever they may be, and we'll work closely with them. Some clients don't want us to do that. So that data belongs to the clients. But what we have, which we own and we have flexibility around, are all of the norms and the benchmarks around how communication works, how advertising works, what's good customer experience, how to drive it, and all of the panels, which are first-party permission-based panels. People are actually giving us permission to understand how they're consuming media in their home and on their tablet. They're giving us permission to look at their purchasing behavior and understand their e-commerce behavior, their traditional channel behavior, where they're shopping, what they're shopping, how they switch brands, all of those types of things. Now, quite often, we're actually matching some of that data with Google and Facebook and Snap and Ali and other ecosystem players to understand the ROI on media. What's the impact of advertising on Google in terms of brand lift or in terms of purchase. And all of those players are moving to a cookie-less world, but we're moving towards direct matching with them. So our ability to continue offering ROI services to clients and understanding how people are behaving and what they're doing and why they're doing it doesn't change going forward.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Once again, as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press the hash key. We now have the question of Patrick Wellington from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Hi, Patrick.
Yeah, morning, everybody. Three questions, quite simple ones, really. The first one is, do you have some stranded costs in WPP? There's a difference between the 30 million difference between the stated Kantar numbers and the numbers in this announcement. Secondly, will WPP have to pay Kantar for data in the future? Is there a sort of arm's length payment arrangement? And how should we think about that in our numbers? And thirdly, this question was asked in a slightly different way, but you know, is 40% the number? If you want milk, do you need to own a cow? Do you have to have 40% of Kantar to have such an arrangement around Kantar's data?
So I don't know which order to take the questions. I think I'll let Andrew take the. I think just on the shareholding, we don't need to own 40% to have access, but I think that it aligns the interests of the two partners and with Kantar, and you know, it's a demonstration of our commitment to our clients of sort of continued participation. In terms of the you know, we already really trade with Kantar on an arm's length basis anyway, so that won't really change in the future. And Andrew, to tackle the cost issue.
I mean, we already, as Mark says, do work on a commercial basis with the rest of WPP. We co-developed some products and services which we sell to clients together. We provide certain services to parts of WPP where we pitch for those services and we win on the merits of what we've got or not sometimes, and that won't change. And we are in conversations with Mark and his team about are there certain products and services that we want to develop on an exclusive basis for WPP. So from a commercial arrangement point of view, you know, there are some of our services where we deal with the whole industry. Our media services, we deal with Omnicom agencies and IPG agencies and Publicis agencies. That won't change, and we'll continue to have the same kind of arrangements with the rest of WPP.
Hi, Patrick. Just touching on your third question, and then I'll come to the first one. I mean, on the we think it's the right decision on the reinvestment. You know, and in effect, it's if you look at the cost as we've outlined, it's 10% of the enterprise value, or close to 10% of the gross proceeds. Just given the way the new company is structured, you know, and given all the importance of the client links, and we just think that's a good investment, and we're very comfortable with that. On the stranded cost, I mean, you're right, but that's built into all the analysis. You know, when the sort of old presentation of the Kantar numbers obviously includes an allocation of costs. As Kantar leaves, the we'll be to the extent any of those central costs don't change, which will be most of them, we will be carrying those costs. But I guess it's just built into all the numbers and all the assessment of the transaction as we've presented it. But you know, the answer is yes. The question.
Great. Thank you.
No one answered your milk question. I'm looking forward to a headline with the with the milk and the cow.
The last question comes from the line of Simon Baker, please, from SG. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. So just one question left, actually, and just to confirm the working assumption, please, behind the return of cash to shareholders. I assume it's at first completion, so just to clarify that. But then as a follow-on from that, given what I understand is your belief in the likelihood of this deal closing, why not commence some of the cash return earlier than that? Have you ruled that out? Thank you.
Andrew? So as I think I outlined on slide 10, at the first completion, you can think of it as kind of a prorating of the transaction. So 86, you know, when that completion happens, which we're saying is early 2020, you can think of 86% of it happening is the easiest way to think about it. Or if it's 90% at that point, it'll be 90%. But the hurdle's 86. That's the best way of thinking about it. And you know, we have strong, you know, belief that will happen, and we'll we don't want to get into sort of publicizing how we think about our return policies on this call. We'll take the right actions as we see appropriate.
All right. So thank you, everyone. Thanks for listening. I think just sort of a couple of sort of concluding remarks. You know, we laid out our new strategy for WPP December 11th. This is an important step in the right direction, both in simplifying and focusing the group, in reducing our leverage. We're very pleased to have a strong partner in Luca and the team at Bain Capital. And, look forward to continuing to work, with them on developing a really strong plan. We think it's a good deal for WPP and a good deal for Eric and the team at Kantar. It's been a positive week for the group overall. We're pleased by the win of the business at Centrica, the media win with Eurostar, and we look forward to seeing you all again August 9th with our half-year results. We managed to bring forward from September, I'm pleased to say. So thank you all, and we'll see you in a few weeks.
That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.